Hello, welcome to the Rotten Horror Picture Show, and welcome to the Waltham Public Library. Our show is we cover films off the Rotten Tomatoes 200 Best Horror Movies of All Time list. And today we are covering our number one movie on our list, which is Jaws from 1975. We were invited here for a Halfway to Halloween event, kind of celebrate Halfway to Halloween. And we figured, well, it's Halfway to Halloween, but it's summer's right around the corner. So what better movie to talk about than Jaws? My name is Clay. With me, as always, is Amanda. How are you doing, Amanda?
I'm okay. I'm here to talk about a bad fish.
Great. Awesome. Great. Yeah. This movie is number one on our list. It has a 97% Rotten Tomatoes score with a 91 audience score. What is your history? We usually say, have you seen this movie before?
Yeah.
But I assume everybody here the answer is yes to that.
Yes.
Have you seen
Jaws before?
I think so.
Okay.
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 That sounds like a great lineup. Amanda.
Yes.
What's your history with Jaws?
I don't know. What is my history with Jaws? Jaws is one of those movies that was just like omnipresent in my life and household. I don't really know why my parents thought it was like fine for an 8-year-old to watch, but it seemed like not on the banned list in my family at all. It was very much like a summer movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's maybe my second favorite movie.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, probably behind Silence of the Lambs.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I love this movie. What about you?
Jaws is something that I have seen numerous times. I can't remember the first time I saw it. But it was...
Neither can I. Not like clearly.
It was one of those movies where I think I had seen pieces of it as a child. I do actually... Oh, repressed memory coming back.
This also doubles as therapy.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If you guys need a turn with the microphone, we can pass it around.
We'll get into the back-to-back of Jaws and Silence of the Lambs later. I remember my cousin watching this, and I caught just the perfect part to scare the crap out of me.
Which part is that?
I don't remember.
Great.
Yeah, there was a shark involved, I think. But yeah, this is one of those movies that I've seen it many, many times. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite viewing experience? Was there like a really holistic experience for you? Because I have a good one.
Okay, don't, so you go.
One summer, they were playing it at the Somerville Theater, in the big theater, in the main theater, and we sat up in the balcony drinking Narragansett, watching the movie in July, and it was just like the perfect movie going, and it was empty. It was like a random like Tuesday or Wednesday during the day. It was the perfect movie going experience for a movie like that. Old movie, old theater, crummy beer.
Yeah. I was watching it one time on my phone, and I...
That's bleak. That's so, like, watching movies on your phone, unless it's out of necessity, like you're trapped somewhere.
Well, it's not ideal. So it's not ideal, but in this situation, I tripped and I dropped it in a pool. And so it added to the experience.
So that's your perfect Jaws watching experience.
Yeah. I watched it through 6 feet of water. It was great.
Wonderful. Love it.
Anyway, we're going to play the trailer for you, and we'll be right back to talk about it.
There is a creature alive today who has survived millions of years of evolution without change, without passion, and without logic. It lives to kill. A mindless eating machine. It will attack and devour anything. It is as if God created the devil and gave him Jaws. This is Universal's extraordinary motion picture version of Peter Benchley's best-selling novel, Jaws.
I just found out that a girl got killed here last week. And you knew it. You knew there was a shark out there. You knew it was dangerous. But you let people go swimming anyway.
Yeah, You yell barracuda. Everybody says, huh? What? You yell shark. We've got a panic on our hands on the 4th of July.
Is it true that most people get attacked by sharks in 3 feet of water, about 10 feet from the beach?
Yeah.
What we are dealing with here is a perfect engine, an eating machine.
We're not only going to have to close the beach, we're going to have to hire somebody to kill the shark.
Bad fish, but I'll catch him and kill him.
Did you hear your father? Out of the water now!
This shark, swallow you whole.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
That's a 20-footer.
25. 3 tons of them.
Hurry up, he's coming straight for us. Don't screw it up now.
Don't wait for me. Now! Shoot!
None of man's fantasies of evil can compare with the reality of Jaws. Roy Scheider, Robert Shaw, Richard Dreyfuss, Jaws. See it before you go swimming.
Okay, Jaws from 1975, directed by Steven Spielberg, written by Peter Benchley and Carl Gottlieb, based on the novel by Peter Benchley, starring Roy Scheider, Robert Shaw, Mr. Holland's sans opus, Lorraine Gray, Murray Hamilton, a bunch of kids, a bunch of Martha's Vineyard locals, and Bruce the Shark, and the music of John Williams. We usually don't put the person who does the music in the starring list, but I think it's pretty appropriate for this one.
It's fair this time.
Amanda.
Yes, Clay.
What happens in Jaws?
Well, according to IMDb.
Oh, boy.
In Jaws. When a massive killer shark unleashes chaos on beach community off Long Island, that's wrong. That's wrong. IMDb is lying to you all the time. It's up to local sheriff, a marine biologist, and an old seafarer to hunt the beast down. That part's right.
It's like 85, 90%.
It's true to the book.
Yeah. Wait, it's Long Island in the book?
We'll get to it later.
Yeah, we'll get to the
Don't
book
worry
later.
About it. Well, Clay, so here's the point in the show. Where we list some things you'll find in the movie. Mm-hmm. Some of these are sort of recurring bits, so if they don't make sense to you, I apologize. Clay, things you'll find in Jaws include insensitivity towards New England culture.
Right off the bat.
Immediately.
The first
stereotyping.
The first dialogue after that opening scene is a slandering of the Boston accent. He's never gonna be an Islander.
No.
Treating us like that.
Yeah. An extremely casual drowning report.
Yeah. Yes, after the girl gets eaten, the next day, the guy she's with is...
Oh, no, like, she must have drowned.
Yeah, he just goes, I don't know. I think she must have drowned.
Yeah. Harry's bad hat.
Yes, he has a very bad swimming cap. It became the name of a production company.
Yes, it did.
Of a director nobody can talk about anymore.
Oh, yikes. Magic Shark Book.
Yes, one of my favorite things, one of my favorite expository devices in movies is the Magic Book, which is a book that the protagonist finds that gives them all of the information they need to defeat the evil or whatever. And in this case, it's a magic oceanography book, basically. And it does a lot of heavy lifting because there's no shark in this movie. So they get to show a lot of pictures of sharks and a lot of pictures of what happens when sharks bite you.
Yes.
And that really goes a long way.
Graphic images. Yahoo's on the hunt with guns and bombs.
Always fun. Staple of 1970s movies, we found.
Yeah.
There's always a scene where a bunch of yokels get a shotgun and a stick of dynamite and go hunting.
Yeah. Especially fun when they're throwing the dynamite into the ocean.
Yes. You know Jacques Cousteau used to do that?
Really?
Yeah. There's a...
Does that work?
Yeah. It does. In one of his documentaries, there's a scene where they throw a bunch of dynamite into the water and just blow up and kill a bunch of fish because it was the easiest way to catch them and study them. It's science. I don't know. I don't know what to tell you.
Ecology has come a long way. One delicious holiday roast.
Mm-hmm. Delicious for the shark.
The shark. One extremely smelly shark carcass.
Yeah, I think Richard Dreyfuss might have been cast solely on his incredible ability to look disgusted with smells. Because he kills it there, and also when they look at the remains of the girl, it's the best horrified smell acting I've ever seen.
But you know that shark carcass was real.
Yes.
And it was really smelly because they had shipped it up from, like, Florida.
Yeah.
And it had been sitting for a while, not well preserved or refrigerated.
Yeah.
So if you watch the movie and you look at that point when they think they've caught the shark, if you look closely, that shark is gross. Like, it's falling apart. It's really gross.
Yeah. And apparently they hung it upside down, and all the guts inside disconnected and just fell towards the front. Tell that to your class on Monday.
A one-word backstory.
My favorite kind. Long-form backstory of characters really bugs me, because it's always very indulgent. And for Sheriff Brody in this movie, they cover it very well, where his wife says, yeah, he just doesn't like water. It's some sort of phobia. And then he cuts her off and says, it's called drowning. And that's all you need to know.
You'll also find a cigarette smoking in the hospital.
Also a staple of 1970s
movies. Yes. Quint's artistic talents, musical talents, poetic talents, bootlegging talents, sailing talents, and monologuing talents.
Yeah, he's a very, he's a jack of all trades.
Yes, he's a Renaissance man.
Yeah.
Pretty good parenting.
Pretty good, yeah. We usually have a bit we do called questionable parenting, because it seems very prevalent in these movies,
yes.
But pretty good.
Horror movies, you often, at best, the best parenting you get is questionable.
Questionable.
So.
If not bad.
Right,
yeah.
Right. This is actually like a solid B with the parenting in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And last but certainly not least, the only PG movie to feature full frontal nudity, severed limbs, and a small child exploding into a geyser of blood.
70s, man.
Yeah.
It was great.
You got it all. So watch out.
Yeah. So, Jaws. Steven Spielberg is a hotshot and up-and-coming director. He's directed multiple TV episodes. He directed the TV movie Duel, and his first film was called Sugarland Express. The producers, Zanuck and Brown, bring him the book, and he can't find his way into it until he realizes it's very similar to Duel. He actually went so far as to say, well, Duel has four letters, and Jaws has four letters. So that must mean something.
Yeah.
And so he
decided. The universe is talking to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he, at that point, he dives in, so to speak.
Bad pun.
Well, you know.
Bad pun.
He gets his great cast, has this amazing robot shark he's going to rely on too much, and 52 days to shoot the first ever film to be shot on the open ocean. Everything is looking up. So on May 2nd, 1974, Steven and the production head to Martha's Vineyard and start filming, and everything goes great. I'm sorry. I meant everything goes horribly. The shark that they tested only in fresh water didn't work in salt water. Two of the lead actors were at each other's throats the entire time, and the ocean turned out to be a smidge difficult to shoot in. But somehow, 150-something days later, they finished the film, and on June 20th, 1975, Jaws was released, and we're going to talk about it.
Yeah.
Now, I want you all to keep one question in your mind, because the list that we work from, the Rotten Tomatoes 200 Best Horror Movies of All Time, is a contentious list, to say the least. There is a lot of movies that you would not consider horror movies on there.
Mm-hmm.
And
the ranking system, we're still trying to discover.
Yes.
How they calculate where things land. They also like to change it every couple months.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is interesting.
We got lucky, because the number one movie, I think, was Psycho, like 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway. But the question is a personal question, what do you think is a horror movie? Do you think Jaws is a horror movie?
No.
We'll have that conversation at the end.
Yeah.
Save your answer.
Yeah, we can bring people up and have them debate.
Okay, so we usually end talking about the music, but we should probably start there, because I would say, much like another horror movie from the 70s, Halloween, this is 75% music makes the shark work, because there's no actual shark in the movie.
It sets, like, any amount of suspense and mood in this movie comes entirely from the music.
Yeah, and it's obviously a very famous theme that is not in the movie as much as you think it would be.
No.
Because I remember when it came, they did a reissue of the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about buying it, but I was like, oh, I don't know, it's just those two notes over and over again. And I forgot that there's so much lush John Williams music through the rest of the movie.
Yeah, there's a lot of like, let's go on an adventure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the actual Jaws theme is very, very minimal.
Pops up when you need it.
Yeah, but they can literally show a shot of a moving piece of a dock, and if you put that music underneath
it... Yes, it makes everything
ominous. It
makes ominous.
It very scary.
Yeah.
But it opens like a classic monster movie.
Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the best movie openings.
Yeah.
Like, period.
What do you like about it?
I like that it gets you straight to what is scary.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in the debate of is it a horror movie or is it not a horror movie, if you judge based off of the opening, that's a horror movie. That's a classic. It's nighttime. There are teens out on a beach having a party. A guy and a girl kind of go off to have some private time. And the girl gets mauled by the shark.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great because you see her... Once she swims out, you see her shoulders up,
mm-hmm.
and they yank her around, and she's absolutely terrified and screaming, and you don't see any blood, and you don't see the shark, but you know what happened.
Right.
And it's such a punchy way to get you into this story, and I think the transition right into sort of the next morning, when it's Chief Brody and this beautiful, idyllic island, mm-hmm. it's such a great contrast.
Yeah.
Throwing that in like that.
That was one of those instances where they were planning on showing the shark. And it's when you hear the behind the scenes stuff about this movie and about how much they wanted to use the shark and were forced not to, you kind of go, maybe Steven Spielberg isn't that good. Because
everybody talks about how this movie is like, it's Hitchcockian.
Which it is.
The way that he hides the shark from you. And it's like, he didn't choose that. That was chosen for him.
And he even since then has said, if he made that movie now, it'd be all CGI shark.
Yep.
And the shark would be everywhere and it wouldn't be as good of a movie.
Yeah, Sharknado.
So he's a hack is what I'm saying. but yeah, it opens, it feels almost like Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yes, I love those shots in Creature from the Black Lagoon, but in this movie too, where it's the camera is underneath mm-hmm. and you see the silhouette of the swimmer above. They're like hauntingly beautiful images for the violence you're about to be thrown into.
In the wake of this movie, water joke, there was another movie, a Roger Corman movie called Humanoids from the Deep, which is like if you took Jaws and mixed it with Creature from the Black Lagoon,
mm-hmm.
and then like sleazed it up by about 45% to 50%.
So a Roger Corman movie.
Yeah, it's fantastic. We're going to talk about it eventually. Don't worry. but yeah, it gets right into Brody. Obviously, Steven Spielberg knows what he's doing, and the opening sequences of this movie show you what kind of filmmaker's hands you're in, because he does such a great job of introducing all of these characters, starting with Brody and his family,
mm-hmm.
moving into the town, and having Brody walking through the town. The kind of moving around the town stuff that he does very often can just be, all right, we got to show the town, let's show the town. But it's actually part of propelling the story forward, because mm-hmm. the reason he's moving through the town is to get the closed down beach signs.
Right.
So it's all very economical. Like this movie ends up being extremely economical in the way it's made.
It's also fun when that's that scene when he's kind of walking through the town. There's a parade going on. There's all this like early summer activity. And if you pay attention, I missed it like over and over again until more recently watching this movie. You're so kind of bombarded with the life of the town that you miss the fact that all the places he's walking by are the businesses owned by the city's councilmen.
Yes.
Which I love. Yeah. Like, there's Vaughn Real Estate, and then there's the Gazette owned by Meadows, and these are all the people who are going to sort of butt heads with Brody over how to handle the beach.
Yeah, and you get a great bit of towny stuff with everybody coming out and arguing about
kids people, karateing the
yeah, people
fence posts.
Parking in the wrong parking space and stuff
yes.
like that.
Yeah.
And I guess a lot of that stuff was improv, which for better or worse.
Yeah, some
we'll
people are better
about
at it.
A later.
Yeah.
What do you like about the town?
What do I like about the town?
Yeah.
Like
the people in the
general,
town.
The people in the town. I think in this movie they feel very real. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody feels sort of like a caricature. The person who gets closest is the mayor. Like, he can sometimes feel like he's being so obstinate just for the sake of the story. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, yeah, you could envision this kind of guy saying, like, well, let's just wait, it'll blow over.
Yeah.
But everybody feels very genuine. People feel like real people in this movie. They even, where we're saying some of the improv works, some of the improv doesn't.
Yeah.
But the way people talk, like, they interrupt one another, they talk over each other, there's things happening in the background, and you can hear, like, Ellen Brody tending to the kids while Sheriff Brody's on the phone. So I enjoy that little kind of slice of life realism that it gives you, mm-hmm. and it really feels like a small New England seaside town.
It definitely does.
Like, yeah. they didn't Hollywoodify it, and they kind of let it be what it is, mm-hmm. where parts of it are very beautiful and parts of it are kind of just like, I don't know, some sand dunes with some scrubby brush on it.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, the improv is, it goes a long way to make everybody feeling very real, and my favorite bit, because it's not the best bit, is in the meeting with after the Kittner's been killed? The I can't remember.
Yes, yeah. Because the bounty on the shark has been given.
They focus in for a second on three people, and there's this one woman who's really going for it, being like, well, I can't afford to shut my store down. I've got bills to pay. And then she turns to the next guy to let him in, like a good improv partner yeah. does, and goes, what do you think? And he just goes, I hope they don't close the beach.
And scene.
Yeah, good enough.
Killed it.
But inside that realism, I think, is the Brody family.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think one of the strongest things in the movie is how much the Brody family feels like a real family.
Mm-hmm.
And a family who isn't on the rocks or something.
You did not read the book.
No. What, are you kidding me?
This is a library.
Yeah.
we can talk a little bit. I did read the book.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk a little bit about some of the differences between the movie and the book, because I do think they're really interesting and they shed light on the movie and some of the choices that the film is making.
Mm-hmm.
We can do that kind of more in full later.
Sure.
But I will just say, as a teaser,
I was going to say, you're not going to respond to what I said?
Brody family, very different in the book. Mm. Very much not a happy family. Mm. Shall we say?
It's too bad.
I know, because it is one of the most charming things about this movie, and one of the things that I think makes it so easy to get emotionally invested, even as you're sort of dropped in Jaws, and there's not a ton of backstory talk, and there's not a ton of like, well, how did Chief Brody and Ellen meet, and when did they fall? Like, we don't get any of that. We don't really care about any of that.
Yeah.
But they seem like they love each other. From the way they treat one another, from the way they treat the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it so easy that to feel a sense of stress and tension and fear when Brody is out on the boat, because you don't want him to die, because he seems like a good husband and a good dad, and like he's trying to do the right thing.
And he's so clearly out of his depth.
Literally and figuratively.
Joke, yeah. I didn't do that on purpose.
I don't know if I believe you.
And yeah, I think one of the things that you get in this that you wouldn't get, that's a very Steven Spielberg thing that you probably wouldn't get from most versions of this,
mm-hmm.
are little moments like the moment where Brody and his son, his mm-hmm. little son is mimicking.
Yeah, they're at the table and they're both doing.
Yeah, it's like at least a minute long sequence
yeah.
that if you were really chopping this movie down, you'd probably take out.
Yeah.
But I think that stuff goes a really long way to make you care about the Brody family. And care about, is it Martin Brody? Is that his first name?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Thank you. him as a character. Because the thing that I really keyed in on this time watching it is, so after the initial shark attack with the girl,
mm-hmm.
he wants
Chrissy.
To quote Chrissy, right.
Chrissy.
The other thing about this show is that I don't remember names. She remembers every single character name.
Oh, don't set me up like that. Now I'm going to forget a bunch
yeah.
of them in front of people.
Welcome to the big time, Amanda. They have that meeting about the initial shutting down of the beach.
By meeting, you mean they ambush Brody on the ferry?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And they really put him into a... But we got into local politics, and he didn't want any part of it, I understand.
I get it. That's so boring. I was here to hear about a shark eating people.
It's very in line with the movie itself. The shark doesn't show up till halfway through the movie. But Brody gets put in a really difficult position.
Yes.
And the not only in the scene with the ferry where they're angling him to keep to not make a big deal out of this because it could be anything, and the coroner kind of reverses what he says. Mm-hmm. After the Kitner boy dies, they have that second meeting, and that's where he says, we're going to close the beach, and then the mayor undercuts him and says, only for 24 hours.
Yeah.
And what I keyed into this time is that the second half of the movie is kind of propelled by the essentially by Mrs. Kitner slapping him in the face. Because it now is not just we have to kill this thing before it kills anybody else. Mm-hmm. It is a redemption arc for Martin Brody.
Yeah.
That is not like, it's not really leaned into in a really heavy way. Like he doesn't have some sort of monologue about how killing this shark is the only thing that'll...
Right, for him to reclaim his feelings of whatever.
Yeah.
I do want to just say, like, obviously, the Robert Shaw as Quint monologue on the orca gets all of the attention and all of the credit as, like, the great monologue of this movie. I think Mrs. Kitner's little smaller monologue at Brody is so well done. Like the way she delivers it, she's so heartbroken, she's so upset, but it would have been so easy for her to play it huge, to come in and start screaming at him and shouting at him and embarrass him in front of the whole town out on the dock, but she's so quiet and she hits him and then immediately sort of like pulls in on herself, and I just think she did a great job. I don't think she gets enough credit for the delivery on that.
I also keyed in on her in the beach scene when her son goes out into the water this time. Because they're doing all this great cutting back and forth and building the tension through one guy has a dog and the dog disappears.
Oh, poor Pippin.
And as things start to get crazy, they keep cutting back to Mrs. Kitner, who is really starting to freak out. And in a way that while everybody else is running away, she's trying to find her son.
Everyone else is panicking in a huge way. They're out in the water, and they're, like, flipping little kids off rafts to get out of the way. Like, full-grown adults throwing the kids behind them, essentially, is, like, bait for the shark.
Yeah.
And then poor Mrs. Kitner, the person who actually has something to worry about, who a tragedy has actually befallen, is on the beach, and everyone's ignoring her.
Yeah.
Like, no one pays any attention to her.
Yeah. Do you think she saw her son explode?
I do not think she saw her son explode.
No, that's probably for the best.
I think that's probably for the best. But I do love that moment of the deflated raft and just like a wave of blood.
So apparently there is an uncut version of that scene where you get the whole, you just see the shark just bite that kid in half.
Wow.
And like, we're talking dummy filled with fake guts bit in half.
The 70s were a wild
Too intense time. For PG, apparently.
The geyser of blood, though. Gotta keep that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, that scene is on the beach is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a thousand filmmaking careers were launched by that the Hitchcock zoom that they do, which I think most people call the Jaws zoom at this point.
Probably.
It's when the kid first gets attacked, they push in on Brody, but it creates this weird vertigo effect where I think it's they push in, they dolly in and then zoom out or something, or vice versa. I can't remember, to create that weird...
Yeah, where it feels like it's zooming in on him, but it's, everything else is sort of rushing away.
I remember seeing that going like, whoa.
Yeah.
Like it sticks with you. It's a really unique camera move.
Absolutely. It's just very striking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned Quint.
Yes.
We see the introduction of Robert Shaw's Quint at the meeting where they talk about closing down the beach, and it's one of the most memorable character introductions I can think of.
Not just for the nails on the chalkboard.
No. I want to know, A, when did he get in that room? And when did he draw that picture on the chalkboard?
Yeah, just while everybody's yelling about their motels or whatever, he's just like quietly... And then a little stick figure and the shirt.
I assume he sent in his little buddy that he has with him.
his little buddy was like a tiny dog and like a bag.
I don't know why that guy didn't go on the boat.
Little buddy who just feeds him crackers.
Yeah. But it's just Imagine being at that meeting and just sitting at the back, casually drawing a shark eating a small child.
And then be like, give me $10,000.
Yeah, but then your buddy's like, what are you doing? He's like, don't worry, it's going to be good.
It requires a lot of setup, but I promise you the payoff will be worth it.
Yeah, but yeah, Quint is an incredible character. It's more incredible when you see Robert Shaw in other stuff.
Yeah.
Because he's a fairly, what's the word I'm looking for? He could be a fairly posh British mm-hmm. actor. I think he's Irish. Was Irish?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he just embodies whatever barnacle this guy crawled out from under so well.
Yeah. No, I love Quint, and I think he's the sort of, like, interesting, because usually in horror movies you have some sort of harbinger. You have some sort of character who comes in, he's like a local to the town or the area, and he knows the whole long history of whatever tragedy and situation's happening. And he comes in and he sort of warns the main characters of peril and mm-hmm. danger and says, you know, you're going to die out there or something. And that should be Quint, but it's like they made him a main character.
Mm-hmm.
They're just like, do you want to just take the harbinger with you? Like, yeah. He'll tell you all of the horrible things that could happen all the time.
Yeah, and his the way that he announces your doom is very fun. Because whereas something like Friday the 13th, you'd have crazy old Ralph.
It's got a death curse.
Yeah, it's got a death curse. You know, you don't know what you're getting into. You know, the Colonel Troutman character from Rambo, who just tells you how bad the thing is you're about to go up against. Quint just laughs at you and sings a song and walks away.
Mm-hmm.
A very appropriate song.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then after this, we get Hooper, who is the last of our main three, played by Richard Dreyfuss. I like Hooper more every time I watch this. I think it's very easy to be a Quint guy, or I guess Brody probably gets the short end of the stick.
I think he does, because he's so much more of a grounded character and, like, sort of just a nice guy trying to do the right thing, whereas like Quint and Hooper are huge personalities and huge characters, and therefore they are constantly butting heads the minute they come into contact.
Yeah.
They can't stand each other from like the get-go.
I don't know what kind of person Hooper is, though, because he gets there, and he's from the Oceanographic Institute or something.
Which is a real place in Woods Hole.
Oh.
Yeah.
He's, you know, talking science. And then he shows up. He shows up unannounced at the Brody household in a tie and a jacket with two bottles of wine.
He didn't know what they were serving.
Right. He invites himself in and then proceeds to eat their food because nobody else seems to be eating it.
Yeah.
Is that something he does all the time, do you think?
It's an interesting question.
Yeah.
I don't know. They seem to have hit it off, right?
Yeah.
Like Brody and Hooper seem that they kind of come to an immediate alliance of, oh, you're talking sense, and, oh, you seem like you actually want to save people's lives. Mm-hmm. Let's our powers combined.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, I don't know if he just walks into people's houses and says, you need that? Can I help you? No.
I've tried it. It doesn't work.
Getting the police called.
Yeah generally. Well, yeah, the thing that one of the reasons I really keyed in on him this time is I really started to notice how from the minute Hooper meets Quint, he is trying to impress him. Because the first time they meet is right before they go out to hunt the shark, where Quint gives Brody the moonshine to drink. And he's like, don't drink that. Yeah. And he hands it to Hooper, and Hooper shoots it immediately. And then starts telling Quint about his bona fides and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's definitely a sort of like, Hooper wants to be in the club.
Yeah,
like,
definitely.
Like, he wants someone like Quint to take him seriously.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's so much of a, I want to impress this person specifically, or more of a younger man just trying to prove himself to the old salt.
Yeah.
You know?
He seems to have two very conflicting sides of his personality, where he wants to be a cutting-edge science guy, but he does also want to be hang with the cool dudes down at the dock.
Well, and it reflected sort of the real-life relationship between the actors, right? Didn't butt heads like crazy, and like Robert Shaw was horrible to Richard Dreyfuss on set?
Yes.
And so a lot of that tension was genuine, those arguments and things.
Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure what started it, but The closest I could find is that Robert Shaw, big drinker, unfortunately. And at one point, they were on the boat waiting to shoot, and he was drinking, and he just said, "I just wish I could stop drinking." And Richard Dreyfuss took the glass out of his hand and threw it into the water. And from that point on, Robert Shaw made his life a living hell.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that animosity definitely does come through.
Yeah. But the three men are such an interesting, they create this really interesting triumvirate between them, because they all have the common goal, but they all want to go about it completely differently. Mm-hmm. And there's a weird sense, at least that I get, and maybe other people disagree, but I get kind of...
If you do,
a,
keep it to yourself, yeah. Please.
No, you can tell me, that's fine. I kind of get the vibe that Quint actually does respect Hooper more than he respects Brody in some ways.
I think he
likes Brody more as a person, but he treats Brody almost like this is a kid. Like this, or not a kid, but sort of, I'm responsible for him. He's not capable of being responsible for himself.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Hooper drives the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And Brody just gets to throw fish guts and blood into the water hour after hour. And where Quint gives Hooper a really hard time when he can't do something or doesn't do something, he just kind of like gently laughs at Brody for not being able to like tie the right knots and things. He's like, "Oh, you'll try again. You'll get it sometime." It's like a very almost condescending.
It reminded me of a father talking to a child, kind
of. Yes.
Because he's very, I guess, kind of in both with both characters, because he's very hard on Hooper in a way like he expects more from this guy. But with Brody, he literally does that thing where Brody screws something up, and then he pulls him aside and like very gently says, "Next time, just ask me which rope to pull."
Right, exactly, yeah.
But yeah, the three of them is a very it's such a dynamic grouping of these characters who, as you're saying, they all have something in common, but they all, I think it's best illustrated by them packing to leave, because you've got Quint, who basically walks onto the boat with a gun and rope.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Hooper shows up with
the
shark cage.
He's got the harpoon tarts and
the harpoon things and everything. And then Brody comes up, where head to toe in like galoshes.
Yeah, like rain gear. Like you're sending your kid off for camp.
And his wife is like, "You have your Dramamine, right?"
Yeah, yeah. There's chapstick in the back pocket.
Yeah, it's like he's going out on a fishing trip.
Yes, yeah. I also think they're an interesting cross-section of like both like class levels, like socioeconomic class levels, but also different types of masculinity, like styles of masculinity, where you have like Quint being an almost over-the-top macho stereotype. He's dirty and he's rude and he listens to no one. He's the only captain on this ship. He clearly doesn't put any stock in Hooper's fancy toys or his education. And then you have Hooper, who is rich, admittedly.
Mm-hmm.
He says it himself, and probably well-educated, and comes in with all of the high-tech gear. And then you've got Brody, who's just this sort of like middle-class guy, just trying to like, literally just trying to do his job.
Right.
As the chief.
Yeah. This is basically, the structure of this movie is really interesting, because it's basically two movies. Because it's just over 2 hours, and they get on the boat to go after Jaws at the halfway point. And it's really interesting to see how they split, because once they get on that boat, it's just the three of them for an hour.
Yeah.
And it's, I think it's built very well to get to that point. And honestly, as much as the town is nice, you don't really miss it once they get on the boat. Because there's so much in this movie that I always forget about that's just like incidental stuff.
Yeah.
Because in my mind, it's like, well, yeah, then the kid gets eaten, and then they go on the boat, and they go kill it. And there's a whole section in there that I'll just, you know, in one eye, out the other.
Like your eyes
do. That's how it works.
Yeah.
Once they get on the water, they do the... I wanted to ask. I'm going back a little bit.
Sure.
You know when the second beach scene, where there's the fake out with the kids.
Yes, the hoax with the two little kids.
Yeah.
With the fake shark fin.
Yeah.
He made me do it.
Do you think Jaws paid them to distract everybody?
He's just over at the dock at night being like, shh. Psst,
it was
kids,
very, I mean...
Kids, come here.
It worked out perfectly. Everybody focused on that, and then he went and ate the guy in the rowboat.
Oh. That's true. The eating the guy in the rowboat scene is pretty
that's
amazing.
That's the scariest part of the movie.
That is one of the scariest parts of the movie.
Yeah.
Like, when his leg, like, his entire leg from, like, mid-thigh down just, like, sinks and hits the ocean floor.
Yeah.
That leg looks realistic,
it
too.
Does. Yeah.
That was a good bit of special effects and things for the 70s.
Yeah, I always thought like that top-down shot of Jaws coming up. That's his name. Jaws.
I thought his name was Bruce. Was that the actor's name? The
Jaws
character's
is his
name is Jaws?
Christian name.
Got it.
He,
his confirmation name?
Yes.
Yeah.
The way that he comes out just appears out of the blackness
oh
of
my
the,
God.
And just grabs him and pulls him down. It was,
and if you know, the funny thing is, like, if I were one of those kids, like one of the boys on his, like, their little skiff that they got in the pond, mm-hmm. and some weird adult man just started like aggressively rowing up, being like, "You guys okay? Do you need some help?" I would also be like, "Can
so
a shark please?"
So I did learn from our friend Sean, who is a big Jaws fan, that that guy is the like the Cub Scout leader.
Oh,
who's from like a couple scenes earlier, who's helping the kids in the water.
Oh,
yeah, you wouldn't know it, but because
okay.
he does just
so
seem
they're
like,
supposed to know him.
I think so.
So it's supposed to make sense that he's maybe checking up on them. Okay.
Yeah.
Because I was always just like, there is a predator in the water and there is a predator on that boat.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, 1970s, very possible.
Just saying.
That always stuck out to me, where it's like, you're basically chumming the water with this character. Because he's just there going, hey guys, you all right?
Yeah.
You got to pull on the rope. Once they get on the boat, this is where when they were shooting the movie, they had to get really inventive because they had tested the shark in the freshwater tanks at Universal Studios,
mm-hmm.
but they hadn't tested it in the ocean because they didn't have enough time. And so when they got there, the shark did not work.
Mm-hmm.
And so it forced them. They shot all of the stuff on land first. And then they had to figure out, when they ran out of stuff on land, they had to figure out new stuff to shoot. So that's where you get stuff like the dock breaking off and then
the
going
delicious
out and,
holiday
yeah,
roast.
Yeah, turning around and coming back. And one of the big sequences they had to kind of scrape together is all of the stuff with the barrels.
Mm.
And which, you know, every time I hear that, I think, what the hell was this movie before that?
Yeah.
Because that's like such a big part of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Were they just not going to do?
I don't know.
Were they going
to? I don't know if it was just going to be an hour of machine gunning a shark or something. But it's
that actually sounds like a very different but kind of fun movie.
Yeah, I mean, I'm here for it, but
I don't know. I'm sure Jason Statham would star in that.
Well, he was in The Meg.
That's yeah, exactly. Kinda, yeah, 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 yeah.
Does he shoot a gun at the shark in The Meg? Yeah. Does he really? Okay.
Oh, all right. Okay. Let's give Quint a rocket launcher and see what happens.
That is one of my favorite parts towards the end is when they're running out of stuff to try, and so Brody just gets his revolver and starts firing at it as it goes by.
Everyone's just frustrated and shooting at the shark. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, they do this this thing with the it's really the same trick as the dock thing, but mm-hmm. they do it to great effect.
Yeah, with the barrels
with
acting
the barrels.
As the sign that the shark is near, but you're not seeing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is really effective. Like, whether they intended it to be that way originally or not, it's so much better just seeing the barrels bob up and then being
especially when they get into, it really, Quint's condescension
mm-hmm.
kind of gets a little bit of comeuppance there, because
mm-hmm.
once he gets hooked to the barrels, he's like, he can't bring that thing under. And then he brings one under. And then the second barrel goes on, and he's like, no, it's fine, we have him. And then the second barrel goes,
the third one.
And once Quint is even flabbergasted by what's going on, that's when you know they're in trouble.
Yeah, and the shark starts getting increasingly aggressive.
Yeah.
Like, it's really hammering on the boat, it's kind of stalking them through the water. I want to ask you, I might be jumping ahead a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but the scene where they are like, forget this, we're going back into land.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this isn't working. This isn't going to work. We've got to get back into shore. And Quint is really pushing the boat. And Hooper says, you can't, like, you got to ease off. You're gonna blow the engine. And Quint pushes it even harder, and it exactly does what Hooper thought. Mm-hmm. Do you think Quint did that on purpose?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah. He has some sort of...
Do you think he knew he was doing it on purpose?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, I mean, he smashes the radio beforehand. Yeah. So he's definitely, he's out there to win.
But he's the one who turns them back in. So yeah, I've always found it a little like, is he really just panicking? Like, is he having kind of a PTSD reaction?
Maybe.
And he thinks he's just...
Yeah, I hadn't considered that. I always thought it was that he has this sort of it seems like he has a bit of a death wish.
Yeah.
Or at least he's a vendetta where he...
He's the Ahab of this movie
He's planned a long time ago to go up by suicide by Jaws. I
think. Specifically by Jaws. See, I don't know if I agree with that, though, because I think there is a genuine terror there from him. Like, I think there's a genuine fear. I think it, you know, the monologue about his experience on the USS Indianapolis and then coupled with once it seems as though they have really lost the upper hand to the shark... he starts to rapidly fall apart to the point where he's even willing to say to Hooper, all right, well, what can all this junk that you brought do?
That's true. Yeah.
Like, he's ceding control to someone else, which I think for that character is, like, a remarkable development.
Yeah, I guess it's very possible that he's just kind of freaking out.
I think he's kind of freaking out.
Yeah, understandable. And because it never lined up for me that sort of... death wish mentality and the way, I mean, obviously you're getting eaten by a shark, you're going to react the way you do, but when he gets, you expect that guy with that mentality, once he gets eaten by the shark, to be like, let's go.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly. And instead he's desperately trying to grab for Brody. Right. Like, he clearly does not want to die.
Right.
This isn't a, like, I'm going to leap at the shark with a machete in my hand.
You ever see,
this is different.
Rain of Fire? Dragon movie?
Yes, I have.
That's what Matthew McConaughey does at the end of that movie. It's pretty awesome.
How do you somehow manage to work Rain of Fire into things, like, frequently enough that it's something I've noticed?
Yeah, have I done it more than once?
Yes.
Oh, no. Well, it's a good movie.
Your secret favorite movie, Rain of Fire?
Honestly, kind of. That was one where when I got to college...
It's Matthew McConaughey's beautiful blank face. Entrancing you.
That was the one where I got to college. I was like, you guys seen Rain of Fire? And almost everybody was like, no.
It's a dragon movie.
It's a dragon movie with Matthew McConaughey, Christian Bale, and Gerard Butler. So you should be all over that.
Did I just hear an audible gasp from
him? Yeah. You got to watch it. It's unbelievable. And it's got some of the best dragon stuff I've ever seen. It's directed by the best director who worked on The X-Files. It's awesome. It's exactly what you think it's going to be.
Yeah, it is. It is. If any of this sounds appealing to you, then you will like it.
Yeah.
If it doesn't sound appealing to you, skip it. It's not worth it.
Imagine Matthew McConaughey playing Quint from Jaws, but, like, dialed up to 15. And, yeah. So
if your knee-jerk reaction to this explanation of this movie wasn't hell yeah, then it's hell no. Like, this is not one I would go to bat for.
That's fair.
Yeah. There's some movies I will, like, try to convince people and be like, no, really, you'll like it. Like, I know it doesn't sound like it.
You're going to like it. Yeah. You're going to like Rain of Fire.
All right, we got to get back to Jaws. Come back.
So, the great thing about the boat sequence is they do allow for...
A musical number?
A musical number. Yeah. And for these guys to really start bonding in a very fun way.
Yeah.
And they manage to do... the best version of another thing that I hate, which is, like, midway through the movie, they always have that scene where everybody, things get quiet, and then they all tell their backstory about why they're doing what they're doing, and it's always terrible.
except in this movie.
Except in this one, where they do it through sharing scars.
Yes.
But, and I know they talk about the Indianapolis, everybody knows about that. What I want to talk about...
Just a hand wave, one of the biggest naval tragedies in American history?
Yeah, we get it. It was terrible. What I want to talk about...
is Mary Ellen Moffat?
No. Is that just in this... The potpourri of stuff dropped in this scene by our friend Quint is the fact that entered an arm wrestling tournament to celebrate the death of his third wife.
Her demise.
Excuse you. Which he then placed second in.
Yeah.
I want to see that movie. They were, when they were trying to make a sequel to this,
yeah,
Steven Spielberg wanted to do, well, what if we did the Indianapolis?
Oh, wow.
No, nope.
That would be a dark movie.
Quint, arm wrestling.
I want to know how he
convinced... For the love of his son and a Mack truck.
I want to know how he convinced three separate women to marry him. How is that man
charming.
Been... I mean, he's got a je ne sais quoi, but, like, he also doesn't look like he's seen a shower in a really long time.
Yeah.
He also seems like he'd be a kind of abusive husband, to be honest.
Yeah.
He seems like he'd be, like, smacking
it's
his
It's a wonder he was married three times, but not a wonder that he was divorced three times.
Yes. Well, she died.
That's true.
Yeah.
Who's to say what happened?
He didn't say ex-wife. He
that's
was
true.
My third wife's demise.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
It's your favorite part of the movie?
It is now. Like, it really stuck out to me this time. And I'm really sad that they never followed up on that. That's the one time where I was like, okay, give me 5 minutes of backstory.
You can, like, pause the movie.
Yeah.
I need to know more.
Yeah. I also would like to mention, I'd like to dispel an urban myth about this movie.
Oh, please.
The shooting star that goes overhead that everybody says is real, fake.
Are you serious?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's so disappointing.
Yeah, I was looking it up online after I was watching, I think it was like Last Crusade or something.
Yeah.
Saw the exact same thing, and I was like, that's too close. And I looked it up, and even though he said it was real, he does it in multiple movies. So.
You're just taking the magic out of everything.
So the shark was a mechanical creation.
Don't tell me that. I thought it was real.
That didn't work.
That is a bummer, though. That was one of my favorite little, like, you know, bits of trivia to tell people about this movie. Like, oh, did you know the shooting stars in that scene? And they're actually happening.
Yeah. It's weird, because that comes up so often,
yeah,
and no one ever brings up the arm wrestling tournament. Of all the fun things that happen in this movie, you see shooting stars all the time.
All the time?
Yeah.
You might need a doctor.
Two movies. I watched two movies back to back that had them, and they were both fake. So at this point, we're driving towards the end. So this is, I would say, if on the short list of movies you could say are probably perfect movies, are you writing the list?
Yeah.
Okay. I think this is probably on there. But this time, I did feel, I'm curious to see how you feel about this.
Mm-hmm.
I think the cage stuff, I think they could have cut that stuff.
Really?
It's good, but, like, as I was watching it, the drive towards the end is building and building, and then it literally stalls out when the boat dies, and then it kind of grinds everything to a halt.
I don't know if I agree, though, because I think the fact that, like, they are stuck, like, they're physically stuck, the boat has literally stalled out, so the action has stalled out, and they're desperate. Because at this point, they know what a threat the shark is. It's killed multiple people. It's started to destroy the boat. It's kind of outsmarted them, even. So the idea of, like, you have to stop and make the decision that you're going to go in the water with the shark. You have to spend the time building the cage and getting ready to go in the water with the shark. Like, that's really scary. And I think it kind of works. Like, you know, the build-up into, like, is he really going to go in there? What is going to happen?
I am also saying this as someone who's watched this movie 1,000 times.
Yeah.
So, but I do think the first time watching it, the fact that it does stop and they do this other bit and that ends with him eating up the cage, I think it's very fun.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Well, it also shows that they've literally tried everything.
Yeah.
They've tried everything and it's all not working.
Yeah.
Plus that footage.
Yes, real-life shark footage.
Yeah.
Of getting... So they shot actual great white shark footage in Australia. And, again, this is one of these weird things that makes me question Steven Spielberg. They wanted to make the shark look bigger, so they made a smaller cage, and he was like, well, we'll just hire a little person to go in there. And so he hired this guy who showed up to the audition, and he was bleeding. And so he said, why are you bleeding? And he said, because I got into a traffic accident, and I really didn't want to miss this, so I came here. And he said, so you left the scene of an accident? And he's like, yeah. I was like, well, you're not supposed to do that. And so he went back, and then Spielberg said, you know, I really like that guy's moxie. Yeah, he really wants that part.
He really wants this part. He's so passionate.
Yeah, so he gave him the part, shipped him down to Australia, and then he was like, I don't know how to scuba dive.
Yeah. I don't even like swimming.
You want me to go in a cage with real sharks? I don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they ended up trying to finagle their way to get this footage, and luckily, one of the sharks got caught in the bridle of the cage and just started, like, whipping around and frantically and damaging the
cage. When you watch the movie, you can tell very immediately what parts of that scene are the real shark, because it's
really effective. Yeah. I've seen some places that say that's why they didn't kill Hooper, because in that footage there was nobody in the cage and they needed to figure out a way to make it line up.
I think that's kind of true. I think they had to rewrite it.
It's weird because it makes it feels so natural that he doesn't die. Or does it? What do you think?
I mean, spoiler alert, but he does in the book.
Yes, I know this.
Yeah. So, I actually think it feels kind of weird that he doesn't die.
Yeah.
Like, I'm glad he doesn't. I like Hooper. I don't want him to die. But it feels strange. Like, it feels weird that Hooper goes in the cage. Cage goes in the water. Shark's in the water, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And then everybody's gone, you know, because he's gone. Shark's on the boat. Quint gets eaten. It's just Brody.
Mm-hmm.
And then Brody defeats the shark, and then Hooper gets to just, like, come back and be like, hey, we did it!
It's like, you hit
on the ocean floor! I did it!
It is really funny when you see him, once he gets out of the cage, there's, like, this in-shirt shot of him hiding behind a rock.
Yeah, yeah!
At the bottom of the ocean. Like, and I guess just stays there until things blow over, I guess.
He's got a whole tank of air, so...
That's true.
Just hang out.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? The boat may have floated, he might have been hard to find, I don't know. It's dark down there.
I don't know. But it is really funny, the idea that he might just be, like, crouched on the sea floor, just, like, waiting for someone else to handle it.
Yeah. But, yeah, the final sequence is just an all-timer. And it happens... That's the other thing about the cage stuff, is it doesn't bother me too much, because the final showdown with the shark happens very quickly after the
cage always
stuff.
Forget how fast, like, in my mind there's always a little bit more time when it's just Quint and Brody on the boat, but it's really quick. Like, Hooper's out of the picture and then Bruce is eating the stern, like, very quickly.
Chops the boat up. Quint,
we have a visual aid,
dead. And then it's just Brody and the shark.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you feel about the way that they set up the oxygen tank?
I'm glad they pointed out earlier. I'm actually really glad they do the little bit where Brody has pulled the wrong rope and gets yelled at by Hooper. Like, these things will explode. Don't you know, you have to be careful? Because otherwise it would have just been like, what?
Yeah, I think they do that in... pretty slickly.
Yeah, I do too.
I was clocking at how many times they remind you that it's there.
Mm.
It's like two or three times they're like...
But only one time they really talk about it.
Yes, only one time they talk about it. But one of the times is a Quint is trying to grab for something to hold on to, and it falls on his hand.
Mm.
And he pulls his hand back, and then he slides into the fish.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
What does that tell you?
I don't know. What does it tell me?
Open-ended questions. Movie Jaws.
Oh, God.
But yeah, it's sort of the best version of the thing that they do all the time in movies, and you can always see right through it. It's basically the crossing the stream scene from Ghostbusters, where you're like, hold on, chill out, one thing, don't cross the streams. Why? It's just bad, don't worry about it. And then you know, well, that's going to come back at the end.
Yeah. I do like that they also foreshadow the boat getting eaten. In Hooper's little story about the time he encountered a shark as a kid, the thing that made him become an ichthyologist.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
He talks about how he had to escape his own little skiff while the shark ate, and he names, like, all these different parts of the boat, and then we get to watch Jaws eat all these different parts of the boat.
And so does he, from the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah.
I guess Peter Benchley was not happy with the way that they blew the shark up at the end.
That tracks.
Yeah.
For him.
Okay. I'm curious to see what happens in the book. That's the end of Jaws.
That's the end of Jaws.
The movie and the shark.
Mm-hmm.
And
R.I.P.
They swim. It would be weird, though, wouldn't it, if it was just the end was Brody swimming back by himself?
Well.
Is that what happens in the book?
Yes.
So this is based on a book.
Yeah. Which is part of what made this so perfect for doing this at a library.
Right, because, you know, books.
Books.
And Amanda was recently on vacation on the beach, and she chose to spend it reading the book Jaws.
I did. I might have a problem. I then started reading In Harm's Way, which is the amazing book about the USS Indianapolis.
Oh, that's so right. You told me that. Yeah.
If you want to get really dark.
Yeah. So did you go in the water at all?
I did. And every time I did, I kept thinking of the quote from the movie that said, is it true that most shark attacks happen in 3 feet of water? And
yeah.
I was just like, go further. Let's just go further.
Yeah. You know, when they, yeah, if you get to 5 feet, you're fine.
Yeah. Apparently.
I love it when movies can very sneakily set that stuff up. My favorite one, because it's so ridiculous, is in The Departed, where during the montage of these guys going through cop school, there's a guy with a poster showing what happens when you get shot in the face.
Oh.
And it's like, it's a drawing of a head and like stuff coming out of the back, and it's like blowback, and he's like pointing at it like this. And it seems weird until you get to the end of that movie when it's 10 minutes of people shooting each
getting
other in
shot
the face.
Getting shot in the face, yeah. So
book versus movie.
Book versus movie. Very different pieces of media. Mm. The book is much, much more focused on class issues. There's this tension between the summer people.
Hold on. Should I get that kid back?
Yeah, come on. Come on. We gotta tell you about class warfare and socioeconomic stratification.
The GDP of Martha's Vineyard is
very
important to talk about.
Well, one of the interesting ways in which they do this is through the Brodies.
Mm.
So Martin Brody in the book is an Islander. Like
he's not from New York?
No.
Oh.
No, and she is from New York, but she's one of the summer people.
Okay.
So the Amity in the book is off the coast of New York. It's like near Long Island. And Brody is a native of the island. And Ellen is one of the people who comes from a rich family, and her family comes and vacations there. And they kind of meet through like a, just, I don't know, serendipitous speeding ticket or something.
Mm-hmm.
You get a lot more of their backstory.
In a boat?
No.
Oh.
She's on a date with another guy, and he's driving her home drunk.
Oh.
And gets in trouble. And she thinks that Brody is a dashing young officer.
Oh, okay.
A love story ensues.
Sure. Tale as old as time.
Tale as old as time. And then, of course, they both end up very unhappy with one another because they're from these very different worlds.
Oh.
And they seem like they want things to work, but they are drifting away from
one
another.
So it's the book is less of a Steven Spielberg movie and more of a Billy Joel song?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. Hooper comes, and he's young and handsome and charming. Ellen sleeps with him.
Yeah, that's the big one that they always talk about,
yeah,
that they cut out of the movie.
Yeah,
is
that
she has an affair with Hooper.
It's weird. There's a mafia subplot. There's
that,
just like,
so tell
yeah,
me about
there's a
that.
Lot going on.
So on all the things that I was watching.
Very different piece of media.
On all the things that I was watching, behind the scenes stuff, they keep glossing over the idea that there's a mob subplot as though there was an arm wrestling tournament.
Somebody comes and kills the Brody family cat in front of the youngest child.
What?
Yeah.
Who?
A mafia guy.
Was it Jaws?
Maybe he paid the mafia guy?
Yeah.
No, so the thing is that Larry Vaughn, the mayor, who's also a real estate agent, has gotten into business with some unsavory characters who are using the shark scare to buy up land and buildings cheap, and then immediately want Vaughn to help get rid of the shark problem, so that now all of their investments will go way up in value very quickly. And
so is the
a lot
theory
money.
That he hired Jaws as to, like, an arsonist?
It's this whole background, and the guy who runs the newspaper is looking into it. But the point of all of this is that in the book, Brody is much more integrated into the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is much more torn between a sort of feeling of loyalty towards the other business owners and long-term residents, and is more willing to kind of go along with their ideas about not closing the beaches and downplaying things, keeping certain stories out of the news.
Yeah.
And it leads him to feeling a lot more guilt and having that redemption arc that you said in the movie. It's pretty subtle that he feels guilty about what has been going on and his complicity in it. In the book, it's much more overt.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Which one do you like better?
The movie. The book is fun.
Hear that?
Like
library?
Yeah. No, the book is fun, and honestly, it's a really quick read.
Yeah.
Like, you can read it really fast.
I always find that stuff really interesting. I recently read Psycho, It's almost like beat for beat the movie, except that Norman Bates is, like, short and fat and bald. That's basically the only thing that's different.
That he's just not, like, handsome.
Yeah. You mentioned the mayor. One of the two things I wanted to talk about that I forgot to talk about earlier.
Please.
Have you watched this? Is this the first time you watched this since the pandemic?
No.
When you did the first time, did all of the shutting stuff down stuff land slightly differently for you?
You know, I hadn't thought about it. I think I very much went into it as like, no, this movie is like my escape.
Sure.
Like, I'm not thinking about current events. I just want to think about a big shark being scary.
Yeah, that's fair. It's funny, though, because sometimes this stuff lands when you don't expect it to.
Yeah.
Like we've talked about before, we watched the movie Wreck, which is a zombie movie that takes place inside a lockdown apartment building and has a lot of guys in hazmat suits. And I think we watched it either in the middle of the pandemic or like right afterwards.
Yeah.
And this is a movie that most people are like, oh, that movie's great. And we're both like, I didn't like that.
We don't need this.
Too soon.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to mention, because this always stands out to me every time I watch this movie, why are all the parents so old? And it's like, it's something that's, because Brody and his wife are on the older side and they have young kids.
Mm-hmm.
Kitner's mother and father both seem to be very old, well, not very old, but like older, like in their 50s.
Yeah, yeah.
And Kitner's a very young kid.
Yeah.
There's not many teenagers in this movie. It's usually, it's basically young kids and older adults.
Right, and there's the college kids from the very beginning.
Briefly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I started thinking, you know, have you seen The Fablements?
No.
Well, you know how people start to read into all the things Steven Spielberg has made because of his family dynamic and all that kind of stuff?
Mm-hmm.
I started to wonder, he made this when he was 26, which is insane.
Yes.
It's one of those things on the list where it's like, Steven Spielberg made Jaws when he was 26, George Harrison was 26 when the Beatles broke up. It's the one that always kills me.
Yeah. I've done nothing with my life.
Yeah. Well, hey, Stan Lee didn't invent Spider-Man until he was 42. So
I got time.
But, you know, he's so young,
And
this stuff seems to come out through his movies. I started thinking this time, does he, as a 26-year-old, not recognize, a 26-year-old who's not married and doesn't have kids, does he not recognize younger parents?
Like, in his mind, like, if you're like, a parent, like, you still know, must be much older.
I'm being serious. I don't mean that as a joke, but, like, it's I was wondering, it's because I kind of feel like I went through a stretch of that when at a certain point where it's like, well, no, adults are like older than me.
Yeah.
And I'm now 40.
Maybe.
So.
Maybe. I also think there's an element of it's a lot scarier when you've got these little kids.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Like when you have small children in peril, that amps up the fear factor.
Yeah.
Because they do age the kids down from the book.
Do they really?
Yeah. There's three Brody children. There's three sons in the book.
Yeah.
And they're like, I think like 16, 14, and 10 or something.
Okay.
Whereas in this, clearly the littlest one, Sean, he's barely not a baby. Like he's Do You Know the Muffin Man in the Sand? Like he's.
Why not make Mrs. Kitner like 25 or something? Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's something that always stands out to me that it's never commented on.
Yeah.
It's just a detail where all of the parents seem to be older.
It is an interesting choice. Yeah. I don't really know if it was an intentional one.
Yeah.
Or
a subtextual, subconscious, Freudian choice.
I do want, if people are interested, and my computer will agree with me. Would anyone object to hearing how the book ends? Does anybody? No? No one objects? All right, I'll do this quickly, I promise.
You're not going to read it.
I am going to read it.
No, they're not going to read it.
It's like, I'm going to read it. It's right here. All right, so this is the very end. Quint is dead. In the book, Hooper is also dead. The boat has sunk. Brody is alone.
Quint dies differently, right? He drowns, I think, right?
Quint dies pretty much the same.
Oh, I thought I read that he gets like pulled underwater and drowns.
He gets pulled underwater and eaten by a
shark. I didn't read it, but I'm going to argue with you.
Now you understand the dynamic here.
Two people removed told me he doesn't die that way.
Yeah. So it must be true.
Yeah.
So Brody is totally alone. He is just like clutching a seat cushion, essentially. Mm-hmm. The rest of the boat is gone. So he's waiting for death. He's in the water, sharks in the water, et cetera, et cetera. He's waiting for death. And this is how the book ends. Nothing happened. He opened his eyes. The fish was nearly touching him, only a foot or two away, but it had stopped. And then as Brody watched, the steel gray body began to recede downward into the gloom. It seemed to fall away, an apparition evanescing into the darkness. Brody put his face into the water and opened his eyes. Through the stinging salt water mist, he saw the fish sink in a slow and graceful spiral, trailing behind it the body of Quint, arms out to the sides, head thrown back, mouth open in mute protest. The fish faded from view, but kept from sinking into the deep by the bobbing barrels, it stopped somewhere beyond the reach of light, and Quint's body hung suspended, a shadow twirling slowly in the twilight. Brody watched until his lungs ached for air. He raised his head, cleared his eyes, and sighted in the distance the black point of the water tower. Then he began to kick toward shore. That's it. That's
it. So the shark just dies?
I guess.
That's terrible.
I got to the end of this book and like tried to, because I obviously read it on an ebook. I tried on my Kindle to like turn the page, and then it was like, thank you for reading this book. And I was like, what?
Did he like just meet his page count quota or something? Or?
I don't know. I don't know if it's. I have no idea.
You guys get it. Control S.
Yeah, pretty much. Yes. It was one of the most bizarre. So when you were asking earlier about how do I feel about them blowing up the shark, I was like, I feel great about
so
it.
So Peter Benchley would have preferred that.
Yes.
Ooh.
Yes.
Boy.
Yeah. Would you also like to hear some alternate titles for
Jaws?
Yes,
please. These are incredible.
Oh my God, you guys.
This, and the ending.
There's so many of them.
This and the ending makes me feel the same way as I do about Steven Spielberg now. I don't trust this guy.
This is a hack.
No.
So this might be a little bit apocryphal. I don't know how accurate this actually is, but the sort of gossip is that when Peter Benchley wrote this book, it was literally going to the printer, and he was out to lunch with his editor, and they were like, well, we have to name it something. We don't have a title. It's going to the printer today. So they were just scribbling down ideas. Here are some of them. Great White, White Knight, The Grinning Fish,
okay.
No.
Dark White, White Dark.
I'm sorry, what?
Leviathan Rising,
okay.
The Coming, Horror, Haunt.
Wait, sorry. He had The Coming and Horror, but not The Coming Horror?
No. Separate. All right. Separate titles. The Fish.
Uh-huh.
Phosphorescence. Looming.
Looming?
Looming. You're going to love this one. Clam Bay.
That's not one word, right? It's two words?
No, it's two words. Oh, Clam, okay. Space Bay.
Clam Bay, yeah.
Spectre.
Okay.
The Edge of Gloom.
The Edge of Gloom.
The Edge of Gloom. Maw.
Did he read his own book?
Maw.
So close.
Penance. Dues.
You told me that one. That one is the most baffling.
Yeah.
Dues.
Like paying dues.
Are we sure that's a title and not just he wrote a reminder to pay his union dues on the same page?
Where was I? This is one of my favorites. What Have We Done?
So I like that one because it edges towards Italian horror movie title, which is overly long and ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, my favorite, Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key. That's how you title a movie.
No. Here's the shorter version of that. Why?
I mean, isn't it the eternal question, though? It's very provocative.
We've also got Shadows of Despair, which I would like to report that he had on his list twice.
Shadows of Despair.
Shadows of Despair.
Who's buying Shadows of Despair and expecting a fish book?
Not me.
Okay.
A Question of Evil.
All right.
White Evil. Havoc. Havoc in all caps, by the way.
Of course.
I don't want to forget that. White Menace. Mm-hmm. Terror, Anguish, The Fish. I think that one's in there twice, too. Requiem White, A Dreadful Stillness, A Question of Evil.
Dreadful Stillness.
A Dreadful Stillness. This one, An Elegant, Splendid Presence. Out of the stillness, an awful stillness, a question of vengeance?
That sounds like either Brody or possibly Jaws ends up with a machine gun.
That's the Jason Statham movie.
That's like a Cannon Films 80s Chuck Norris movie where he fights a shark that killed his family.
I've got just a couple more. Jaws over Amity.
So close.
Over Amity.
Yeah.
The Fish at Amity. Pisces Redux. And then another one in all caps that just says past. So they had been batting around all these different titles and
they put these in the book?
There's a whole bonus area. That was not a comprehensive list. There are so many.
This is why as a creative person you don't let people see your sketches. Exactly why.
But so they were there. The Benchley and his editor are batting around titles at this lunch, and the ones that they start to kind of hone in on are the ones that include the word Jaws. Mm-hmm. And so they say, well, you know what? The only thing we seem to agree on is the word Jaws. So let's just call it Jaws. And the editor goes, okay, but what does it mean? And Benchley goes, I don't know. And so that's what they titled the book, and then that's what they titled.
Fish have them.
They are scary.
They're big.
They are big.
What does it mean to you personally? It's different for everybody.
Yeah.
That's what art is.
Up to interpretation.
It means what it is.
Yeah.
You know, like it sounds. the one thing I didn't realize is, so you said the book takes place in Long Island?
Yeah.
Apparently the only reason they picked Martha's Vineyard was because it was the only place they could find with a sandy bottom 12 miles out that was only 30 feet down.
Oh.
So they could sit their shark sled. That didn't work.
Outside of the sight of land, I'm assuming. Yeah.
Yes, because Spielberg didn't want to be able to see land in any direction because he wanted to make it clear that they were actually on the ocean and not in a tank somewhere.
Yeah.
The movie was the first film to be released on 400 screens at the same time and effectively created the modern blockbuster film, for better or worse. Over 67 million people in the U.S. saw it, just under a third of the country's total population at the time. Yeah. Nominated for Best Picture, but not Best Director for Steven Spielberg. Mm. And it's there's a video you can find on YouTube of he and his friends were watching the Oscar nominations, and he was like 100% sure he was going to get one, and he doesn't. And much like in The Simpsons, you can pinpoint the exact moment where his heart rips in half. But luckily, he's got his buddy there. I can't remember his name. The guy from Maniac and The Godfather. This big Italian guy who was in like four of the best movies ever made and then died. One of those guys. There was a couple of them. And he's like, who made that movie? Who made that shot? This guy. He should get the award. And he's like, thanks, buddy.
That's a real friend.
Yeah. There were three sequels of varying quality. Okay. You know, what was the question of vengeance? That should have been the name of Jaws 4, because that's the one where Jaws follows them to Jamaica to kill them, to kill the rest of the Brody family.
Are you serious?
I am 100%
That's really
serious.
The plot of that?
Yes.
Great.
Starring Michael Caine, of all people.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And it has a lasting impact, people still studying it and dissecting it, and even trying to solve crimes with it.
Ah, yes.
Have you guys ever heard of The Lady of the Dunes? No. So, would you like to give us a rundown of what The Lady in the Dunes is?
Sure.
I forgot to look it up.
In 1974, a young woman's remains were found in the dunes off of Race Point Beach near Provincetown. She had been obviously murdered. She had had her hands cut off. And I believe, I don't remember if she had any, like, head or facial mutilation or anything.
It seemed like it was one of those, like, whatever was done to make it impossible to identify.
Yeah, exactly. And so she remained...
Could it have been a boating accident?
No.
Okay.
One of the things that sort of mystified and horrified people was that she was found and her clothes were sort of neatly folded in a little pillow under her head. Like, she had been very much left there on purpose. And so she remained a Jane Doe, and, mm-hmm. and she was referred to as the Lady of the Dunes for decades. Recently?
It was in the past, like, less than 10 years ago.
Oh, God, yeah. They identified her as a woman named Ruth Marie Terry.
Oh, okay. Yes. They identified her. I was going to say, the person who brought this... The reason that we're talking about this is because Stephen King's son, Joe Hill, who is also an author, thought that he had identified this woman in the background of Jaws.
Yeah.
And
It was based on her, because they had sort of, you know, forensic sketches of what she must have looked like. They knew what her hair color was. They knew her height, her kind of build, things like that. And so, yeah, in the scene where the ferry is coming in and bringing all the tourists in for 4th of July weekend, there is a woman who bears a resemblance to those initial sketches. And Joe Hill was pretty convinced it was her.
Yeah.
It was not. Mm. She was just some poor girl who had, like, decided to be an extra in the film.
Yeah, yeah. That's too bad. Man, people are weird, aren't they? Like, what, you cut her hands off, but you're like, you know what, she needs a pillow.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
Yeah, well, her husband did it.
Oh, well, obviously.
Yeah.
That's usually what it is.
He was a bit of a career criminal, mostly, I think from what I've read, it sounded more like slightly more petty things. He had been suspected, I think, of murdering another woman.
Mm-hmm.
But genetic genealogy and all of that stuff that's been coming out in true crime recently, they use that to identify her and identify her killer.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So, mystery solved.
Yeah.
No more mysteries about Jaws. There's no Lady of the Dunes in Jaws, and the shooting star
shooting
isn't real.
Fake.
So we're just here to ruin all of the trivia.
Also,
about
Bigfoot's
Jaws.
Not real. The Loch Ness Monster is fake. That's the one that kills me. I wish the Loch Ness Monster was real.
What about the Lake Champlain Monster? Have you not heard of the Lake Champlain Monster?
Champ?
We can talk later.
It's the one I wish was true and scares me the most.
The Loch Ness Monster?
Yeah. Always scared me. Probably because I watched this movie too young.
Yeah.
I think that's going to do it for our coverage of Jaws, but I did ask you a question at the beginning of this discussion. Is Jaws a horror movie? This is number one on our list.
Mm-hmm.
Amanda, how do you feel about that placement? Would you call Jaws... Can we, hands in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Jaws,
yeah.
Horror movie? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Ooh, are we going to get...
Not a horror movie?
Are we going to get a perfect 50-50 split?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Oh, come on.
Wow, you guys are great. That was amazing. We've been sliding our table away.
That's all right. Am I doing that?
Yeah. What do you think?
My first instinct is no,
mm-hmm.
because it's too well made. it's really tough because is it any less of a horror movie than, say, the giant tarantula movie from the 50s? Mm-hmm. It's still a monster movie.
Mm-hmm.
Is it less of a, well, I guess Godzilla's not a real horror movie either.
Yeah. But
I would say it has definite monster movie DNA
mm-hmm.
in it,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know if naturally occurring giant shark is enough of a scariness factor or whatever. We have a, this is a running question on our show because we run into a lot of movies that the question is valid. And one of our other friends, Wes, he described a horror movie as it has to have a supernatural element in it.
See, that I disagree with.
But that's not like exclusively like ghosts or something. But like,
sure.
So I could theoretically classify this, the supernatural element, as a gigantic, abnormally huge shark.
And kind of abnormally smart, right?
Yes.
It's sort of tricking them
and
outsmarting them.
Good with money. Smart enough to pay those kids off.
This is tough for me because I want to say yes. Like, mm-hmm. I want to say, like, yeah, it's a horror movie, but I think I have to say no.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's part of what makes something a horror movie is also those sort of genre trappings and stylistic choices
mm-hmm.
that signify to the watcher, you know, you are watching a horror movie. So much of this is an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
So much of this is, a man versus beast, man versus nature struggle. Like, Moby Dick's not a horror movie.
That's true.
So why is this? Just because there's some gore in it? There are plenty of gory movies.
Well, picture a version of Jaws where Jaws the shark has very sensitive hearing. And so everybody on Martha's Vineyard has to stay very quiet, and it becomes a very quiet place.
Yeah.
Would that then make it, is that any different, really?
Also, counterpoint, one of our other friends said one time, how could it be a horror movie? All you have to do is get out of the water.
Great point.
Just don't go in the water, and it can't get you.
Great point.
Yeah, makes it a lot less scary. So I think I have to say no, which is ironic because it's number one on our list of horror movies.
Yeah, that's really tough. It's really tough to have the number one movie be debatable at best.
Yeah.
I guess then we will keep it a 50-50 divide.
Yeah.
Just for the sake, because I don't think it is, but I'm going to say I do just to keep it. Split.
Just to keep the statistics.
Yeah. But I think that's going to do it. Let's say, would you keep it on the list?
No, I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Because so the list we work off of that the website Rotten Tomatoes hosts is the 200 best horror movies of all time. There are a lot of horror movies that have been made in this world, and if you're picking the 200 best horror movies, you're not picking the 200 best movies.
True.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, if this were just the 200 best movies of all time, yes, I would put this on the list.
Where would you put this in the video store?
You're asking me like I remember what the categories were in a video store.
Anyway, doesn't matter.
Under the blockbusters, right?
Okay, sure.
You know?
It makes sense that if it's going to be on the list, it's very high. But I don't know if I would necessarily keep it on the list.
Yeah.
But
an unsatisfying answer from both of us.
Yes. Much like this show.
Yeah.
Since we are in a library, a couple book recommendations is obviously Jaws by Peter Benchley, and also The Jaws Log by Carl Gottlieb, who was the screenwriter. That started off, it was going to be a chronicling of the making of the movie, written by Gottlieb, Steven Spielberg, and Brown and Zanuck, the producers.
Oh.
And then the other ones said, we're not going to do that. And so Carl Gottlieb had 2 months to write a book about Jaws.
Wow.
And so he did, and it's what was the first making of thing that came out about this, and there's been many, many since, and you can find them all over the place, DVDs, YouTube, anywhere you would like to get your information about Mr. Bruce Jaws the shark.
I will add to the book recommendations, if you, like me, are compelled by Quint's monologue and you are interested in the history of the USS Indianapolis, the book In Harm's Way by Doug Stanton is, I'm like three quarters of the way through it, and it's been amazing. It's horrifying and upsetting, but it's true, which, I don't know, I think it's worth reading about.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, it's quite a bummer.
Yeah. Well, on that note.
Yep.
Thank you guys for coming out to listen to this. Thank you to the Waltham Public Library and Sue for having us.
Thanks, Sue.
And thank you for everyone listening. And we will be back next time with Nosferatu 2024.
Yay.
See you guys. And remember, it's only an island if you look at it from the water.